You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the U.S. government reportedly extracted a high-level Russian official in 2017 who'd been collecting information on behalf of the U.S. We'll talk about that story and why the spy was pulled out of the country. Now, the Wisconsin Department of Transportation unveiled a new multi-million-dollar grant program to fund transportation projects around the state. The $75 million initiative would be split up between local governments for multimodal transportation projects, from road repairs to bicycle lanes to harbor projects and more. Our next guest joins us to talk about the grant program and how it fits into the state's overall transportation goals. Craig Thompson is Secretary Designee for the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. Secretary Thompson, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, give us the basics. What would this project do?
So this is a $75 million program, really of one-time money that was transferred out of the state's general fund. And so with that, the governor set up a program where local governments, our counties, cities, villages, and towns, we've created criteria that each they could submit projects for review, and we would have them graded against that criteria. And it would really be by their peers. The counties can submit 12 people to review their projects, the towns the same, the cities and villages. And they have to be able to demonstrate that they're going to have an economic impact. The three pots are split up about $26 million for the counties, a little over $18 million for the cities and villages, and about $28 million for the towns. And so since this was one-time money, felt it was important that they go towards discrete one-time projects. And the other thing the governor thought was important, that he opened up to more than just roads. So while these do have to be for one-time projects and can't be for ongoing operations, transit could have a successful bid for, a garage or bus or improvements or something like that, as well as with ports and the other modes.
Is this viewed as something for urgent needed repairs, say, on a project, getting something back into shape, or could it be for a new project altogether?
Yeah, it's for improvement projects, specific one-time projects, and there's a cap for any one grant of $3.5 million, and there's a floor of $250,000. It's programs that would fit in that mode. And we believe there's a lot of demand out there from the locals, and we've been hearing a lot of enthusiasm from each of the statewide associations. So we're anticipating receiving a lot of requests and proposals.
If I'm a local official listening right now thinking, yeah, I got one of these, how do I sign up?
Well, we've got all of it on our website at the DOT. We've got all the process for how they can go about submitting. We've announced the project now, and the criteria is out there. We're working with the Towns Association and the counties and the Cities and Villages Associations for them to give us the recommendations for the individuals to sit on the review panels. But people can start submitting projects now, and the deadline is December 6th.
And did I see there is a bridge project that's already being funded in part by this?
Yeah, that's a great point, Rob. All of these are going to be competitively placed except for there is one set aside, and that's for the Kakana Bridge, Lift Bridge in Kakana, Wisconsin, for the city of Kakana. The legislature had actually put an earmark in for that to come out of the local bridge program. The governor vetoed that because he was afraid that $1.6 million would have eaten up almost the entirety of the local bridge program. But in his veto message, he did say that he thought that the DOT could find other ways to fund it. And so we talked with the locals, and they thought this was worthy. And so we put it as a set aside in this project.
Talking to Craig Thompson, Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation, looking at a grant program through the department to help local government units, the counties, cities, villages, and others, do local one-time transportation projects in their area. And Craig, is this something where the locals have to pony up at least some of the cash?
Yes, it's going to be on a 90-10 split, 90% from the state and 10% from the locals. If they've got a project where they can put in more than 10%, it would certainly help their competitiveness, but they can be on a 90-10 split.
Now, $75 million, in some ways, Craig, it's a lot of money, but for the state's overall transportation needs, there's a lot of other stuff going on. What are some of the other challenges and key budget items you're looking at with the state's transportation spending?
Well, I think the most important parts of the budget really are the ongoing programs. you know, the governor in his initial proposal wanted to increase funding for our state highway rehabilitation program, which is the program to fix our current two-lane highways of $320 million, and the legislature agreed with that. And so that will be an upper that will be ongoing with ongoing sustainable revenue. There is also a 10% increase for general transportation aids to the locals. Unlike this program, that, again, would be ongoing for them to maintain the current roads they have. So those are the ongoing sustainable programs that we really think are going to help us move, do better planning, and move forward long term. This one-time program is something that the legislature initially put in to go in the local road improvement program with money out of the general fund, and the governor made the changes in the ways that I'd said before.
And someone, what are some of the top priorities for your department when it comes to transportation projects, maybe some of the more big ticket items that were maybe put on hold over the last few years?
Well, in this budget, we did have the legislature included and the governor signed. There is money in there to finish the zoo interchange down in Milwaukee, what had been known as the north leg of the zoo. I-43 between Milwaukee and Grafton was enumerated, meaning that will begin to move forward. And then the legislature independently put in I-41 between Appleton and Green Bay as a new project to put in, and the governor concurred and signed that. So those are some of the big projects that will be moving forward in the future.
One of the big controversies over the last few state budget cycles was not on the spending side so much as the revenue side. Talk about whether the state needed to increase the gas tax, for example, or user fees or more borrowing. What ended up coming up in this latest state budget when it came to the revenue side of things for transportation?
Right. So the governor had proposed an 8-cent increase in the gas tax and returning to indexing like Wisconsin used to between 1980 and 2006, which is really the route that most of the states, both red and blue across the country, have gone. But the legislature went a different route. So they proposed to increase our registration fees. That's when you get the sticker on your car every year. It was $75. That was increased by $10 to go to $85. And then when you transfer the title on your vehicle, that was increased by $95. It was $65 before that. So those were the two main areas of revenue increases that were passed that will be ongoing and sustainable.
And Craig, finally getting back to the grant program we started off by talking about, give us the timeline up to when we can actually start see some projects getting the shovels ready.
So like I said, the deadline for submittals will be December 6th of this year. Then they will be reviewed, you know, throughout over the winter, and by next spring, we believe we should be seeing some of these projects, some earth being moved.
Secretary Thompson, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Craig Thompson, Secretary Designee for the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. He joined us to talk about a new $75 million state grant program aimed at funding local one-time transportation projects around the state. Coming up next, the United States reportedly helped one of its top assets in the Russian government escape that country in 2017. We'll hear about the reported reasons why and the role intelligence plays in U.S.-Russian relations. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, attorneys general from 50 states and territories, including Wisconsin, are starting an investigation into Google for possible antitrust violations. We'll find out why and what it can mean for other big technology companies. Now, CNN broke the news yesterday that the United States had helped a high-level Russian official flee from Russia in 2017. The unnamed source had been providing the United States with intelligence. According to the CNN report, the official was removed from Russia over fears that the Trump administration's handling of classified information could endanger the informant. Other reports, though, say the official was pulled out after publicity over Russian interference in U.S. elections. Our next guest joins us to talk about the news and how intelligence gathering plays a role in U.S.-Russian relations. Ted Gerber is a professor of sociology and director of the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia at the UW-Madison. Ted, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, before we get to this Russia story, some news broke since we gave you a call. John Bolton, a national security advisor, is now out. He says he quit. The president says he was fired. Your reaction to this news and the impact it could have on U.S. National security policy?
Well, it's not altogether surprising to me. Bolton has been well known for his particularly hawkish views and his support for concepts such as regime change and for the use of U.S. military force. And that has seemed to run counter to a lot of what Trump has actually done, despite some of his bombast and bold statements, that Trump seems to, particularly recently, you know, for example, with his policy with this these negotiations with the Taliban, he seems more keen on pulling back U.S. forces from involvements and avoiding foreign entanglements as part of his campaign promises. So Bolton's general perspective was at odds with Trump's from the beginning, and it's not altogether surprising that that kind of came to a head recently.
Now, moving to this apparent spy news, multiple reports now that the U.S. had helped this Russian official leave the country, leave Russia in 2017, who had been providing the country with information. What do you make of this story? I know the Russian government's calling it a pulp fiction, basically. What do you make of this story?
Well, I think the story is credible. I certainly would dismiss the Russian government's denials. Nobody, least of all Putin, wants to ever admit that they've been spied upon. If the story, even in its broad outlines, is true, which I tend to believe, the U.S. successfully planted a spy at the highest levels. He was privy to some very private deliberations among Putin and other Russian elites. I do think the initial claims in the CNN story, that according to which it was asserted that part of the reason the decision was made to exfiltrate or extract the individual from Russia was concerns about Trump's, shall we say, carelessness with respect to handling intelligence. I do think that's questionable. And I think the subsequent New York Times article strikes a bit of a better balance. To me, the most striking thing about this story of all is, to me, it sort of should put an end to any doubts that might be out there about Putin's direct involvement in the U.S. election influence campaign, as well as Putin's preference in that campaign to lead to a Trump victory. I think, at the time, what I think was quite telling is when this initial discussion happened and the U.S. intelligence agencies made their determination, it was widely reported that that particular claim, namely that Putin himself was involved in the decision to try to influence the U.S. elections, and secondly, that the goal of that campaign was not to just cause chaos, but was specifically to lead to Trump's election, or that was the goal. I'm not here claiming that was a causal factor, but that is what the Russians wanted to happen. That those claims were based on human intelligence from a very highly planted source. And, now we see this extraction. It certainly looks awfully to be the case that indeed this individual was had direct observation and direct knowledge of those plans, and certainly many other things. So I think, if anything, the main takeaway from this in terms of our understanding U.S.-Russia relations should be that if there's anybody out there who still doubts, I mean, perhaps the president still doubts this, he's stated as such, but maybe some of his supporters do, maybe some skeptics of the mainstream media do, but those doubts should be laid to rest, that Russia did try to influence the outcome of the 2016 elections, and they did so in order to favor Trump.
And as reported in that New York Times piece, I think it was the news about that Russian effort breaking out might have been part of the motivation for helping this source leave Russia, right?
Absolutely. So I think the way these things work is that, when that news report comes out that somebody, in the upper echelons had given information to U.S. Government sources, well, then, of course, on the Russian side, the Russians are very keen on capturing and arresting and disposing of any intelligence leaks or any intelligence risks, and as we are, as any government is. And so they start to ask, well, who would be privy to such information? And so that would allow them, or that would lead to a situation where the noose, so to speak, would be tightening around the informant, around the source. And so, it stands to reason that when that came out in the news, and then media organizations perhaps start to ask more, well, who is this person? What is the basis for that? That would certainly turn up the heat on the individual in question, who apparently had been given the option to exfiltrate previously, back in 2016, under the Obama administration. But he initially had declined, but then perhaps, you know, the argument goes that, well, both sides gave a second thought to this, given that it was released that that particular claim was based on human intelligence.
Getting back to that human intelligence idea, President Trump has publicly said and reportedly privately said a lot. He doesn't like the idea of trying to turn sources in other countries. He's publicly said he wouldn't have tried to recruit members of Kim Jong-un's family, for example, to spy on North Korea. What do you make of the president saying he doesn't like this, in part apparently because it could interfere with his personal relationship building efforts with the world leaders?
Well, I mean, that reflects a very idiosyncratic and some, including myself, might see very naive view of how politics, how geopolitics works, that every country, you know, with a respectable government that seeks to play a foreign policy role perceives that it has adversaries in the foreign policy realm, and it has intelligence operatives whose job is to gather information that lead to advantages in the pursuit of policies. And it's extremely naive to suggest that we should, the U.S. government or any government, should turn away from that particular option in order to maintain smooth relationships between leaders. It reflects a view of foreign policy and foreign policy conflicts that is extremely simplistic, as if, you know, just by patting each other on the back and striking friendly relations with a foreign leader, the United States will be able to obtain its foreign policy objectives. I think, Trump came to Washington saying that he was going to do things differently, and this is certainly a case where he does seem to intend to do things differently. In my view, and in the view of many, it's a huge mistake.
Talking to Ted Gerber, director of the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia at UW-Madison, professor of sociology there, looking at the U.S., Russia, and international intelligence efforts. Ted, pulling the camera back a little bit, Russia was kicked out of the G8, now the G7, for the occupation of the Crimea. President Trump wants them back in, even though they're still there. We've also seen, I think, some prisoner exchanges between Russia and Ukraine. Where are we with our current relations between the U.S. and Russia?
Well, we're really, I think we continue to be at an impasse. I think if Trump had his way, he probably would lift the sanctions and reincorporate Russia in the G8 and take steps to try to, to acknowledge Russia's annexation of Crimea and would back off. You know, I understand that, for example, the U.S. government has promised some weapons to the Ukrainian forces who are fighting against Russian-backed insurgents in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine, and that the Trump administration is slow-walking that process, so they're conducting all kinds of reviews in order to delay. But the U.S. government has a foreign policymaking capacity that doesn't reside entirely in the figure of the president. And there's a State Department, there's Congress, there are other factions, there's many different bureaus within the executive branch that wield influence on foreign policy. And so the U.S. government itself has been divided in terms of the optimal policy to pursue with respect to Russia. And I think that continues to be the case. That the Russians, from my perspective, seem to have, made their bet on Trump, and they've been quite patient. You know, so far he hasn't delivered them anything tangible in terms of, something they could really hang their hat on to say, well, putting him into office has helped us gain this. But he is quite clear that he's inclined to go that route, and he's being held back by the kind of anti-Russian sentiment, particularly within the U.S. Congress, but also in the foreign policy-making establishment. And so, there may be slight movements in this direction, that direction, but really I would describe the situation as we're locked into the status quo, where there's sort of quiet U.S. Action to oppose Russia's foreign aggression in Ukraine, and the Russians fight back by making things annoying for the U.S. in terms of its negotiations with North Korea. Russia has made overtures to China and is trying to establish that alliance as a sort of a counterweight to U.S. global power. Where the U.S. government is divided between the Trump and his supporters who seek a rapprochement with Russia and seek to make concessions to Russia in the name of striking some sort of nebulous deal, although it's never been clear to me what it is the U.S. is going to get out of that deal, versus the foreign policy establishment in the Congress, who are very suspicious of Russia and continue to see Russia as a dangerous adversary, which must be thwarted.
Now, we saw, I think it was George W. Bush, who said he had looked into Putin's soul and saw what he liked there. Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, brought the reset button over. Now, President Trump, is there something about American leadership that keeps getting something wrong about what can be built on a personal relationship with Putin?
Yes, I think there's been a tendency for American leaders, you know, going back to Bush, to exaggerate the role of Putin. Russia is a very large, complex, modern country. It's a rich and diverse society, and Russians don't all agree on everything. Even within the Russian elite, there are divisions, there are factions. A lot of what drives Russian politics is somewhat opaque, so it's natural for outsiders and for, you know, government officials to invest a lot in the figure of a single individual. But I think a more successful longer-term policy would try to engage Russian society and Russian elites on various levels, you know, economic, social, to try to build more contacts. Now, you know, Putin is a very strong personality. He's a very strong figure. He can't be ignored by any means. But I think a more balanced policy approach would involve a multi-pronged effort to deal with Russia, to try to diminish the barriers that divide our two countries on multiple levels, and not to be so fixated on Putin as our leaders have tended to be.
Ted, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
That's Ted Gerber, professor of sociology and the director of the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia at UW-Madison. He joins today to talk about U.S.-Russian relations in light of the news that broke this week that the U.S. had extracted a Russian spy who had been passing info to the U.S. back in 2017. Coming up, we'll talk about an antitrust investigation into Google being launched by attorneys general from almost every state, including Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:15 on The Morning Show, find out how fires in the Amazon rainforest are connected to us here in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow morning at 7:15 here on the Ideas Network. Now, attorneys general from 48 states, plus the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, announced yesterday that they're launching an investigation into Google for potential violations of antitrust law. A smaller group of state attorneys general are also behind a similar probe of Facebook. In July, the federal Department of Justice started investigating the companies that control big portions of social media and e-commerce. Here's Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton speaking in front of the U.S. Supreme Court building yesterday.
This is a company that dominates all aspects of advertising on the internet and searching on the internet, as they dominate the buyer side, the seller side, the auction side, and even the video side with YouTube.
Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call added to those comments, tweeting, quote, "We must ensure that competition over technological innovations and privacy protections isn't stifled." Hal Singer is a managing director at the management consulting firm Econ One Research and an adjunct professor at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business. He specializes in antitrust law. Hal, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Can you tell us more about what these attorneys general are looking into when it comes to Google and possible antitrust action?
Sure. They're looking into whether Google has violated the antitrust laws. And to do that, this would be a Section 2 case, a single firm monopolization case. Now, there haven't been many of those in the intervening 20 years since the famous Microsoft case. And what you have to do to succeed here is you have to connect a restraint of trade that is engaged in by the defendant, in this case Google, with some kind of injury to a consumer. And that's where things are going to get very interesting, because, as you know, on the consumer side or the user side of their platform, it's a two-sided platform, consumers don't face positive prices. It's quote unquote free. Now, of course, it's not really free because we're giving up something. We're giving up our privacy and our sensitive data. So what the AGs signaled in their announcement yesterday and in the lead up to it is that they're going to focus, at least initially, on the other side of the market, on the advertising side. And it makes complete sense to me as an antitrust practitioner. And that if the game is connecting some restraint to a price effect, you would start naturally on the side with prices, and that's the advertising side.
And accusations are that Google has tried to control kind of every step, as we heard the Texas Attorney General say, every step of the advertising chain. And when competitors come up with similar products or parts of products, they buy them and integrate them into their systems. Is that something that the Attorney General will be looking at?
It is. There's a notion now that Google might insert certain provisions in their contracts with advertisers and publishers that make it harder for those third parties to deal with rivals up and down the distribution chain. And so that to me is a natural area that is very, very conducive to antitrust inquiry, because again, you have a restraint. It goes outside of the firm, and it might be connected to some price effect. And if that's true, then I think you have the beginnings of a plausible case.
Right. There's nothing illegal about my company being big, but if I use the bigness and the power that provides to try to keep other competitors from even getting into the business, then I could run into antitrust trouble.
Correct. And I just to put a finer point on it, and the way that you get there, the way that you show antitrust injury is you've got to connect the restraint, or what we call the challenge conduct, with some kind of effect. And the effect doesn't have to, but often takes the form of a price increase or of an output reduction. And so it seems to me that all the signals that we got yesterday and leading up to it is that the way they're going to at least initially construct their case is to look on the advertiser side and see if they can somehow connect what Google is doing to higher advertising prices.
One of the arguments, as I understand it, that a company like Google might make with the advertising prices in particular is that, hold on, there's competition. Facebook, for example, makes money from advertising, so we don't control the whole shebang.
Yeah, they could make that argument, but all that's going on in the background of some well-constructed economic model that either is going to show or it's not going to show that the conduct that's being challenged had the effect of inflating prices. So, yes, there is some competition, as is in every antitrust case. There's never an airtight perfect, or there's rarely an airtight perfect monopoly on earth. So what an economist has to do to show harm in these cases is to control for all those other things and try to isolate the effect of whatever restraint is being challenged.
Talking to Hal Singer from Econ One Research, looking at an attorney's general investigation. Most of the country on board with this, looking at Google. There's also one looking at Facebook. There are questions about Amazon. There's federal investigations going on. And Hal, let's talk about this. For a long time, I think there's an idea, especially in Silicon Valley, that, hold on, these companies are different. The old antitrust rules don't apply. There's a scale that it just makes sense for these companies to get really big like they are. Now, all of a sudden, it seems like antitrust cases are coming out of the woodwork. What's going on?
Well, so they have been flying under the antitrust radar, and there's a seminal paper by a law school student at Yale named Lena Khan that explains how Amazon has been able to evade antitrust scrutiny, and another scholar at Columbia, Tim Wu, is a leader on this front. But there's this notion that Professor Wu uses, it called price fixation, the price fixation of antitrust, and it means exactly what it sounds, which is it is very economic centric, and it typically entails a proof that, again, I sound like a broken record here, that the conduct, right, that you're engaged in is somehow leading to higher prices. That's where a lot of antitrust cases have gone. And so by not charging at least the consumers in their two-sided platforms a positive price, it's made it very hard for antitrust enforcers to try to come up with a theory for how these platforms are causing anti-competitive injury. And so they've been able to skirt or dodge or evade enforcement for that reason.
So one, Timothy Wu was on the show a while back, and as I dimly recall, it's been a while, one of the concerns he said that should be considered with antitrust is, okay, is Google or is Amazon preventing companies from entering the marketplace, companies that could ultimately have given consumers either a lower cost good or a better service good or a service that provides better privacy, things like that. So ultimately there's a harm, but it's not really, it doesn't fit into that immediate cost model you were talking about.
Yeah, I think what you're describing is what I would describe as an innovation harm. And so the idea here is that, and all the platforms are doing it, but it's really easy to see with Google and Amazon. But you know, they've figured out how to leverage their platform, whether it's in e-commerce for Amazon or search for Google, into what are called ancillary or adjacent markets. That is, and so for Amazon, if Amazon wants to take over some vertical, whether it's diapers or you name it, anything that's being sold, right, it can make sure that users are steered when searching for that product to the Amazon affiliate. And it can even clone what is now popular on Amazon. Just so you know, I'm going to do a private label of whatever is selling like mad, and I'm going to make my own, and then I'm going to steer people to it. And the concern is not a short-run harm, right? Because if anything, when Amazon steers, you know, clones a product and then steers a search to its affiliated clone, it's very hard to say where the injury is in the short run, right? If all I'm doing is I'm being diverted from an independent over to Amazon and sometimes even at a lower price, where's the harm? The harm from an economic vantage is in the long run. And what we're worried about is if these independent merchants are sitting there and watching the appropriation take place, you know, before their eyes, they would rationally say to themselves, you know, why would I go through the effort of trying to come up with some whiz-bang device to be sold on Amazon if all that's going to happen is they're going to steal it and then steer searches away? And so what the concern is from an economics perspective is that this kind of appropriation and discrimination could deter future innovation at the edge, and that could in turn lead to a reduction in choices for consumers in future periods. But again, this is very speculative. It's hard to quantify, and it's why I think the antitrust lens is not the appropriate way to go for these types of harms. So just to repeat, I want to be careful. I don't want to suggest for a second I'm pouring rain on this parade. There are viable antitrust theories that work on say the advertising side of the market for Google. But what I'm very worried about is going into a courtroom where the only harm that you have is an innovation harm at the edge that we can't see, that we can only speculate, and could happen in future periods. If that's all you got, then I don't like those odds when I go in. Trust court.
Well, you just hinted that there might be a better remedy for that kind of innovation harm. What would that be?
Right. And so a lot of scholars, I'll start with this piece by the Stigler Center, and it was led by a professor at Yale, Fiona Scott Morton, who did a stint in Obama's DOJ. And she and her co-authors, there's an Oxford co-author, Ariel Ezrahi, there's something like five, I won't name them all, but let's just take my word, these are kind of antitrust heavyweights. And they came to the conclusion that for certain types of conduct, like this discrimination, that could lead to innovation harms in future periods, that regulation, not antitrust, is the proper remedy. And in particular, what they advocate, and what I've been advocating for as well, is the notion of a non-discrimination regime, and task some either new agency, that's what they are calling for, or I would say you could give it to the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, task them with policing discriminatory acts by vertically integrated online platforms, but pursuant not to the antitrust or consumer welfare standard, but instead pursuant to a different standard, a discrimination standard, in which complainants would at least have a chance at succeeding.
Talking to Hal Singer, Managing Director at Econ One Research and Adjunct Professor in Georgetown University's Business School. He's with us to talk about antitrust investigations into big tech companies like Google. Wisconsin is on board with one of those with other attorneys general around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1110. 1234. What questions do you have about antitrust law and how it could or could not apply to companies like Google, Facebook, or Amazon? Are you concerned about the dominance of these big companies? If you work in the digital field or online sales, has this affected your livelihood? What, if anything, do you want to see the government do? Regulation? Bust up the trusts, if they are in fact trusts. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Hal Singer, Managing Director at Econ One Research and Adjunct Professor at Georgetown, looking at a new state-led antitrust investigation into Google. There's also other antitrust action targeting other big technology companies at the state and federal levels. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Google and Amazon are too big, too economically powerful, too able to stifle competition and to set their own terms for consumers? Or do you appreciate the services they provide and aren't too worried about that? Do you want to see more regulation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Hal, we were talking about regulations. Maybe you say they need to be changed. Is our legal system, our legal framework, our regulations kind of out of date when it comes to these big technology companies?
They are. I mean, the problem is that, for example, if you look at what tools the Federal Trade Commission has to go after one of these platforms, and if we focus on these innovation harms that we were just touching on before the break, you know, if you were to pursue this under an antitrust standard, I think you'd have a very difficult time. And I go back and I cite the results of the Microsoft appeal, whenever the harms couldn't be seen or felt or touched by the court, whenever they were even slightly speculative, the court was willing to undo. This is the appeals court was willing to undo the findings of the district court judge, and we don't have a lot of other innovation cases, you know, in the interim. And so to me, that's the mismatch, is that the Federal Trade Commission doesn't have the right tool yet to go after this sort of conduct. And so to me, the simplest shot to getting there is for Congress to give the FTC a new line of authority, a new standard, and the standard I would call a non-discrimination standard. And I like to cite back to what Congress did to a nearly identical problem in the early 90s. At that time, the dominant platform of that era were cable operators. And cable operators, tell me if this sounds familiar, started vertically integrating into content and appropriating ideas on the edge. You know, if they saw a home shopping network, for example, they'd copy it, and then they would pull the independents' home shopping, and they would give preference to their own. And that gave rise to the 1992 Cable Act, and Congress gave the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, a new line of authority. And in Section 616 of the Act, it said we want you, the agency, to police acts of discrimination by vertically integrated cable operators. So, and importantly, not pursuant to the antitrust standard, but instead pursuant to a new non-discrimination standard. So I think the template is there. We don't have a movement yet in Congress to put it together.
Let's bring on a caller now. Peter is with us in Brookfield. Peter, hi.
Hello.
What do you think, Peter?
Well, I personally think that Amazon and Google should be given room to perform. I mean, they're successful. I mean, that's, you know, part of what we, you know, this country's about is that achieving and celebrating your success, and others, you know, employees, other companies that manufacture, win. And their integration into the way they market their product and get it to the public is going to help other companies. It'd be like if you're holding your back, it'd be like the Beatles. You say to the Beatles, "Guess what? You guys can't resist Hey Dude." You know, it's a little too good. Sgt. Pepper, that's way too good. I mean.
Peter, thanks for the call. So Peter's saying, and I'm sure Google would be happy with this, don't punish success, Hal.
Yeah, no, and we're not. And so if you listen to my remedy, and I want to contrast it with, say, Senator Warren, Elizabeth Warren's remedy, I would give Google a free license to go into whatever vertical or adjacent market they want, right? There's no stopping them. So listen very carefully, because it's a subtle difference. What I'm saying is that once they go into some vertical, say local search you probably have heard cases about Yelp complaining that Google has steered searches that previously went to Yelp now to its own kind of local search and review site. They're free to go into that business. They just can't use their platform in a way to unlevel the playing field and to steer all searches to their own affiliate. Now, I want to distinguish this kind of non-discrimination regime that I'm laying out with Elizabeth Warren's solution, which is structural separation. It's a fancy way of just saying that Google couldn't do anything except basic search. So they would be barred from, say, going into mapping or shopping or any of the verticals that they've taken over. And then I would sympathize with Peter's concern, which is that why shouldn't Google, if they do a better map, for example, or they do better shopping, why shouldn't they be allowed to get in that space? And I sympathize with the concern, and I'd want to express that if we could go my way, Google would be free to compete in those areas. They just couldn't use their platform advantage to artificially, you know, slant the playing field in their favor.
But isn't that where it gets tricky? Isn't it kind of hard to tell if Google is slanting the playing field? It's in it might be buried in lots and lots of code the way they do that.
Yeah, it might be, and so that's why these things would have to be adjudicated or on a case by case basis. So you know, I go back to Yelp. Yelp is convinced that when you they've hired these data scientists who have figured out that if you trick Google, including Tim Wu, a name that we mentioned before, if you trick Google into reverting back to its organic algorithm that does not give any preference to the property based on its affiliation with Google, then you get a different ordering of search results than you will under Google's current algorithm. That was kind of complicated, but another way of saying it is that Google appears to be moving up its properties in the rankings based on affiliation with Google. And the problem with that is that if you're thinking about a mobile interface, the user is only going to see a few results. And so Yelp or the independent in this example that would have otherwise made it to the top is now being buried in a place that no one sees. And so it's a long way of answering your question. The way that you make these determinations, I think, is on a case-by-case basis, and you allow some independent to bring a complaint and say, hey, we're being discriminated against, and I'd say prove it.
In our last minute or so, Hal, the attorneys general from around the country are doing an investigation. They're not bringing any charges now. Is there a chance that the investigation brings out some things that are damaging from a public relations standpoint to these companies and maybe leads them to modify their behavior voluntarily?
Well, that's a very good point. I imagine that just the spotlight alone of an investigation is going to cause them to moderate some of their behavior. I think that Google and Amazon, Facebook, and even Apple, they all have the potential just to basically swallow the internet if they want. They can take all of these verticals. I think the only thing that restrains them in part is not really an antitrust law, but just a concern about what the reaction would be of the public if they saw that much of independence were driven from their platforms. So I do think the more that a spotlight is shined on these practices, the more the platforms will tap the brakes on some of the most egregious examples that we read about in the paper almost daily.
Hal, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me.
That's Hal Singer, Managing Director at Econ One Research and Adjunct Professor at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business. He joined us today to talk about an antitrust investigation into Google launched by attorneys general from 50 states and territories, including Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's the first week of action with Congress back in session. We'll find out what's at the top of the agenda for both parties and both chambers in our weekly roundup of national politics. Marquette University has a new rule regulating campus protests. We'll find out what changes and how it fits into a national debate on speech and politics in higher education. Plus, it's Wisconsin's most feared species. It's been the bane of humankind and even dinosaur kind for millennia. The author of a new book gives us the inside story of the mosquito. that and look at the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, surveys show a lot of people say they don't belong to an organized religion. So what do they believe and not believe? An expert on religion joins the program. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a children's book expert tells us how to create a love of reading in our kids. You can share your thoughts, your stories, and your book recommendations on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.